Welcome into the six here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Max Herz alongside Elijah Campbell here for the next hour, talking March Madness and some Preds tonight. Late night Preds for the second night in a row. Predators and LA Kings tonight. Pre-game coverage starts at 8:30 here on 102.5 The Game, with puck drop just after 9:30. Tonight's game, by the way, if you're driving home from work, going to watch the Preds game tonight, it's on ESPN Plus tonight. So only on ESPN Plus on your computer, phone, TV, however you watch ESPN Plus, and it will be on the radio as usual right here on 102.5 The Game again. Puck drop for that one at 9:30. We will have Jack Fraser, who many of you know as JFreshHockey on Twitter, joining us at 6:30 to talk some Preds. So plenty of hockey talk to come, but Elijah, let's start with March Madness. I know you are heated, enraged, as our local college basketball expert, Willie Donick's Wooden Award voting advisor.
You wear a lot of chief advisor.
You wear a lot of college basketball hats, and your bracket is in absolute shambles.
Oh,
and
it's horrific.
The SEC, Iowa, and others are to blame.
Yes. So the SEC fell apart. The SEC, Big Ten, and the Big Ten, I don't want to say completely SEC'd because
You are using Big Ten as a verb.
Yes.
Okay.
They Big Ten.
Just wanted to make sure.
They had all these good teams, four teams in the top 15. Three in the top 10, and I want to say top five. I think Tennessee in the AP was like five going into the tournament, which nobody knows of because no one gives a damn about AP rankings when teams are actually seeded for the one event everybody waits for. But out of those four teams, only one got to the Sweet 16, and that's the team that was outside the top 10, the team that started off, 0-3 in conference play? Or 0-2 after losing to Vanderbilt and Texas A&M to start off conference play this year. The only team to beat Arkansas at Arkansas this season, by the way, was Vanderbilt.
The only team to beat any of the top four teams in the SEC in their home arenas was Vanderbilt. Out of 36 total tries against Auburn, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Arkansas, Vandy over Arkansas was the only one.
Incredible.
In the first conference game of the year for Vandy.
Incredible. So. And this Arkansas team is the one that's in the Sweet 16. So, like, the SEC was a colossal disappointment. I had Kentucky going to the Sweet 16. I figured Tennessee would have made it past Colorado State. Well, that didn't happen because they didn't play Colorado State. They played the team that underachieved all year long, and scrappy underdog Michigan, you know, historic underdog, low-funded school,
mid-major
Michigan.
No resources up there in
Ann Arbor. 11-seeded Michigan came in and took down Tennessee, so Tennessee flailed out early. And then Auburn, in what would have been a classic football game in 2002, Auburn-Miami leading wire-to-wire and absolutely beating the brakes off of an Auburn team that was number one in the country for at least a month of the season. So, yes, the unpredictability has been off the charts, and yes, I'm glad you mentioned Iowa. Still mad about Iowa. Daddy Ball ruined Iowa. So that's my explanation. That's my explanation there. That's how that happened.
He's Elijah Campbell. I'm Max Herz, and Elijah, I'm going to brag on my bracket a little here for a second.
You're good. Like, you're in the top 10%.
I am in the 91st percentile. All four of my final four teams are still in. It's the 3-1 seeds that are still left were my 3-1 seeds to make the final four. That's Gonzaga, Arizona, and Kansas. And then my last one is UCLA in Baylor's region, who's still alive. And
has an easier path now.
Kind of took out Baylor. I only picked two of the six SEC teams to make it to the Sweet 16 and to win two games. One of them was Arkansas, so I got that one right.
Okay, good call.
The other one was Tennessee, who I would have had going basically as far as they could without running into Arizona or Gonzaga.
Yes.
Thankfully, they were in Arizona's region, so I only had them in the Elite Eight.
Same.
Not in the Final Four, but I would have had them beaten anybody else. So Tennessee had me fooled, but other than that, I had Auburn going down in the second round. Unfortunately, I had them losing to USC instead of Miami.
You had Pac-12 fever.
Oh, yeah. Bill Walton.
Bill Walton's Pac-12 enthusiasm is contagious.
Bill Walton would have loved my bracket, and last year it worked out. All of them went deep, and then this year they only got three teams in, which is ridiculous to me. Doesn't last year help them? No, it apparently doesn't. But, I had Auburn losing second round. Unfortunately, it was to the wrong team, so I don't really get any credit for that.
Which is a
bummer. And then the other one that really would have given me points over everybody else in every other pool, I had Murray State beating Kentucky in the second round.
And then you had the golden ticket.
So when St. Peter's won, I thought I got a free Sweet 16 team that nobody else had, and then Murray couldn't beat St. Peter's.
Which is a crazy story, by the way. So, like, you want to talk about how improbable the St. Peter's thing is? Like, you can explain the other recent 15 seeds to make to a Sweet 16. This is only the third time this has happened. Ironically enough, it's happened in back-to-back years. But those other teams had, like, one or two qualities offensively where you're like, yeah, that makes sense. Oral Roberts, elite three-point shooting team. Max Asemus coming into this year was a Wooden Award watch list player. And Kevin O'Banner transferred out to be a starter on Texas Tech, who is in the Sweet 16 playing against Duke and has a really good chance to make the Final Four. Best defense in the country. The Florida Gulf Coast team back in 2013, Lob City, they played with great tempo. They were an elite three-point shooting team. They had that knockout punch that that Davids need to beat the Goliaths in this tournament. And St. Peter's has none of that. They don't do anything particularly well. They just shot 9-for-17 from three against Kentucky. Hung around long enough. Kentucky also going 1-for-6 from the free throw line in overtime is some March magic voodoo that you expect around this time of year. And then Murray State just forgetting how to play on offense is also remarkable. And the St. Peter's team, without any particularly great knockout punch or attribute that makes them better than other mid-major teams, has found themselves in the Sweet 16. It's wild. That one is so unexplainable to me.
You love the OVC. Murray State was probably better than a 7, right?
I don't love the OVC this year because there were only three good teams in it. I think the drop-off,
very top heavy.
The drop-off from Belmont to SEMO State is the Grand Canyon. I mean, that's exactly what it was. SEMO State was the fourth seed going into that conference tournament, and they were an atrocious watch this year. The bottom of the OVC, UT Martin was bottom like 20 in KenPom. Tennessee State struggled almost all year long, got a little better as the season went on, and like the rest of the OVC was really, really bad.
But I bring this up to say Murray was good, right?
Murray was. They were that good. And that's why it made me think that they could have beaten St. Peter's. They played so many teams of St. Peter's caliber this year and taken them to the woodshed. And at the same time, they also, when they played at UT Martin this year, were taken to overtime or pushed to the last minute of the game. SEMO State should have beaten them towards the end of the year as well. Like, Murray State had only a couple of those games, which is what you expect in in your league. But the one thing that I didn't expect is for St. Peter's to not just like have a lead in the second half, but to make it like a 10-point lead. Like, Murray State was playing from behind all second half. Murray State was bigger than them. They were faster than them. They played with better pace than them. Murray State has a 6'5", 6'6" point guard in Tevin Brown, which is just a total mismatch for any other mid-major team. And St. Peter's still, in that second half, led almost the entire half.
Max Herz, Elijah Campbell here on the 6, talking some March Madness. All right, Elijah, let's talk about those Vols. Second round game, Saturday, early evening, Michigan 76, Tennessee 68 in Indianapolis. The Vols were 2-for-18 from three. Who are we putting this one on? The shooters, the coaches, somebody else? Have at it.
Yeah, see, this one's the hot button topic of the week after obvious Rick Barnes's obvious record in March, which he is about right at 500. I think he's 25-25 in the NCAA tournament in his career, like a flat 500. And he's had players such as LaMarcus Aldridge, Kevin Durant, DJ Augustine, TJ Ford, Admiral Schofield, Grant Williams, and then this year's Tennessee team had a lot of really great teams and has never been able, outside of the one time he went to the Final Four with Texas back in 2003, has not been able to get back, and I think he's only made the Elite Eight once since then, too. So people will rightfully so look at coaching as, oh, Rick Barnes did it again. I just don't think this is one of Rick Barnes' more atrocious choke jobs. I think it's kind of lower on the list because I don't think there was anything that happened in the game plan that caused them to lose. The Vols got open shots. They just missed a ton of them. They did shoot 2-for-18 from three. Zakai Ziegler was 0-for-4. Santiago Vescovi, the guy who is the only other Vol player in the history of the program to make over 100 threes in a season, not named Chris Lofton, who is one of the greatest three-point shooters in the history of college basketball. He shot 1-for-5. He couldn't make any two-pointers either. He was horrific on offense.
So
Michigan just took him out of the game.
Do they need an offensive approach change in a situation like that, or should they have kept shooting like they did?
I think they should have kept shooting. I think when you're at least that good enough as a shooting team, like, I hate the phrase living by the three and dying by the three, because you can live and die by anything. If you're a good offensive rebound team and the other team just is more physical, you lived and died by your rebounding. Or if you're a good two-point shooting team, you get to the layup or get layups a lot. You get to the free
throw
line.
That's literally what being good at something is.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. It's literally what being good at something is. Like Bruce Pearl, I've heard Bruce Pearl say that once at a SEC Media Days a few years ago, and I was like, that makes a ton of sense. Like, that's what Tennessee's offense was really, really good around. And I thought that was probably better offensive strategy because Hunter Dickinson was cheating back. Like, he was going to make sure that if Michigan was beating guys off the dribble, that they're going to get funneled into the 7-1 rim protector. You're probably going to have an easier time anyway, especially considering Tennessee is not a very good two-point shooting team. They played to their strengths, and they got open shots and just missed them. And offensively, that's kind of what happened. Defensively, it wasn't their best game, but it wasn't like it was atrocious. It was also a faster-paced game than what Tennessee's accustomed to by about 5 or 6 extra possessions. Michigan was only about a hair over, or about 1.08 points per possession, which is good. That's a good offense performance, especially against an elite Tennessee defense. They just weren't able to get enough buckets, I guess, down the stretch, and they kind of crumbled apart when they had the opportunity to. I think a lot of that just comes on the circumstance of the game. Sometimes you get lucky in those. Sometimes the other team is the one that's missing those, even if you're missing on defensive assignments. A lot of that, like what Tennessee's downfall in that game was shooting, and then also the forwards not being able to guard Hunter Dickinson. He should not have had 27 points because he shouldn't be able to push around John Fulkerson like that. John Fulkerson's 40. He should not have been pushed around in that game. That guy has been playing basketball. I think Wade Houston recruited him to play at Tennessee. He should not have been pushed around like that. That was inexcusable, and I kind of really think that's where Tennessee lost the game on Saturday.
Would have been Tennessee-Villanova in the Sweet 16. Instead, it's Michigan-Villanova. And really quickly here, Elijah, I will let you get an agreement or disagreement in with me, but game of the tournament so far, Arizona and TCU to finish up the first weekend in overtime. That's my game of the tournament. The two big moments both came in the last 15 seconds of regulation. Benedict Mathurin, NBA range 3 to tie it up with 13 seconds left, just absolute stones. And then the steal at half court, which I don't think was a foul, by the way. That call in their favor. And then Dalen Terry is staring at the clock.
and
all
tries
he needed to do was just do any other type of shot. He could have laid it up. He could have gone underhand. He could have bounced it in. He could have done so many things.
Just get the ball out of your hand in
time,
man.
And he dunked it. And even after he put it in, all of his teammates knew. You could tell they knew the game wasn't over. He thought it was over. He was the only one who didn't see the clock.
It was one of the greatest acts of or lack of self-awareness in like the NCAA tournament this year, which made it for a fantastic finish because all this is unfolding in 5 seconds. And I'm glad you mentioned that was not a foul. Everyone was crying on Twitter about a foul. And you know damn well as I do that if they would have called that, the amount of tweets you would have seen of, oh, you can't let that play decide the game, that would have flooded the internet. People would have absolutely lost their minds if a game was decided because of a bump foul near half court when that idiot dribbled into a double team. Like, the real foul should be on common sense for not dribbling into the corner on a double team where you can get trapped like that and milk the clock away. That's exactly what happened. They got what was rightfully going to happen anyway. Yeah, there's too many complaints about that not being a foul.
So is that your game of the weekend, or do you have another of the tournament so far?
I think San Francisco Murray State.
Okay, that was going to be my number 2.
Up and down, up and down. That one going into overtime. Justice Hill battling cramps. Two of the best mid-majors in the country going pound for pound, swapping leads. I think that one, to me, in terms of just entertainment value of two very evenly matched teams playing to their potential, I think that might be where my vote goes, but watching Benedict Mathurin alone was what made Arizona TCU.
That's my title pick.
That's a good one.
Let's
go. I'm in the title game. That's a damn good team.
Yep. Let's go U of A. I still don't know why their motto is Bear Down. But,
I've never gotten that
Bear
either.
Down, I guess.
For the Wildcats.
He's Elijah Campbell. I'm Max Herz. We'll take a break, come back. We're going to talk some Preds the rest of the hour. Preds won 6-3 last night. They remain in playoff position. Made a move at the trade deadline to get Jeremy Lauzon, left-handed defenseman from the Seattle Kraken. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the win last night. Philip Forsberg is still on the team and has the most goals of any player in the history of the team, both all-time and in a single season. That's pretty good. That's why you keep that guy. We'll take a break. Talk some Preds. This is the 6 here on 102.5 The Game. Welcome back to the Six here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Late night Preds for you tonight. 8:30 pregame, 9:30 opening faceoff. Out in L.A. between the Preds and the Kings, third and final meeting this season between a couple of teams that are more than likely to be in the Western Conference playoffs. So we'll see if the Preds can sweep the back-to-back after beating the Ducks last night by a 6-3 final. I'm Max Herz, Elijah Campbell alongside talking some puck. We'll have Jack Fraser, Jay Fresh Hockey joining us in about 15 minutes here on the show. Pretty crazy game last night, Elijah. High scoring. As Pete Weber pointed out, I wouldn't even have thought about it this way, but it is the Preds' second consecutive 6-3 win, and they came in very different ways. But the Preds played from behind a little bit last night. They were down 1-0 in the first period, but did not trail again after that. And the thing to me that stood out the most about this game, the Preds' four best players, their four best skaters, I'll say, not UC Saros. UC Saros is
in a category
definitely,
of his own,
yeah, he's definitely up there with those guys. But the Preds' four best players were their four goal scorers in this game. Roman Josi scored the first goal, Ryan Johansson the second goal on the power play. Then Philip Forsberg and Matt Duchene each had a pair. Both of Duchene's goals were on the power play. Forsberg had a second chance breakaway goal, and then he had an empty netter. This is why you keep him. This is why you keep Philip Forsberg on the team, even if you don't have a contract done. He's a free agent this summer. Could have been a rental for somebody else. At one point, a lot of folks were looking at it like either the Preds sign him by the trade deadline, which was yesterday afternoon, or they trade him to somebody else to get something for him. He's your guy. Mm-hmm. He's having the best season he's ever had. You have a lot of players having the best seasons they've ever had. All four of those guys are. You see Saros is too. And I mean, even down the list, even more players on this team are. That's why you got to keep them. See how far they can take you this year and then get it done in the summer.
And it's not like, you know, you're going to be signing a contract to a guy. It's not there's a good baseball example. He's not Brady Anderson. For those who aren't familiar with Brady Anderson, former Baltimore Oriole great, we talked about him on Darren Donick and Chase today, and it made me think, and of course, I think the conversation was different, but I was like, yeah, this guy was a good player his entire career, and then, of course, hits 50 home runs in 1996, and then never gets above 24 again in his career. He did that at age 32, which I think we can all probably guess that there might have been some juicing going on there without pointing any fingers, but Philip Forsberg is 27 years old. Like, he's entering the prime of his career. So I understand it's a contract year, yada, yada, yada. But maybe he's just figured it out. I think that's also, I don't think guys play harder during the contract year. I think sometimes guys just figure it out. Like, he's doing this on a nightly basis. He's also staying healthy. How many years now has there been a stretch of Predators hockey in which Forsberg misses a week or two and the Preds have to kind of survive that stretch? It happened last year a little bit. It's happened in years past where he does get hurt maybe in January or December and misses some time, but he's been reliable. He's been really healthy this year, and you're getting a full season of him, and this full season looks really, really good. That's worth investing in.
He has 35 goals.
There's 19 games left.
He is
broke a record with 19 games left.
He's the first player in the history of the Nashville Predators. 19. This is season 23 of the team. First player in Nashville Predators history to score 35 goals in the regular season. And, oh, by the way, his line mate and teammate and power play mate, Matt Duchene, is now tied for the second most with the previous record holder, Victor Arvidsson, because he scored his 34th goal last night. So the next time Duchene scores, the Preds will have the only two 35-plus goal scorers in team history in a single regular season, playing together in the same season.
On the same line.
Yeah. You don't break that up.
That's amazing.
When David Poile said last summer that this was going to be a more competitive rebuild, and he didn't realize how much those words would be used, and he's phrased it different ways. But if I'm a fan of the team, I don't understand why any fan would want the best player traded away.
No.
If this is a
not.
Rebuild... This is the type of rebuild I want.
Where you're still making the playoffs and have this kind of production.
This rebuild was, we're keeping most of the group together. We're going to try and play a little bit differently, which has worked mostly because they're getting skill level production from their physical players, really Tanner Janot first and foremost, and it's working. Like, if it works out, we're going to go for it. Just because maybe they weren't going to go all in if it didn't work out doesn't mean they have to trade their best player while it is working out. Like, we are living in the best case scenario right now for the Predators. Are we not?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because of the expectations you laid out beforehand, and then you're still having, like, here's the thing with Philip Forsberg, too, is you mentioned the longevity, him being 27 years old. He's going to be part of some really good teams for a while. Like, are you going to get this Matt Duchene for the rest of his contract? I don't know. I mean, if you look at his career, it's kind of, there's been some up and downs. He's already broken his personal record for goals in a season, by the way, which is insane. Like, you're getting the best version of Matt Duchene. Is this what you're going to get next year or the year afterwards or like and for the rest of his contract? I don't know. But I feel pretty good about seven more years of Philip Forsberg. Maybe not, even if it's not this good, still being really good. Still being better than almost any offensive production you've had in your franchise's history. If you're the Predators, this is a fantastic position because what have we complained about the last couple of years? The Stars aren't playing to their potential or they're not getting enough scoring. The offense isn't there. They don't have a lot of scoring depth. Like, we've heard a lot of this kind of stuff, but this might be like the most explosive Predators attack in franchise history. Like, the defensive side, as long as Roman Josi's on your team and as long as you still have guys like Matthias Ekholm and you have relatively good depth on the defensive side, you're going to score enough points to win if Juuse Saros is your goalie. Your margin for error is extended. And with him being as young as he is, playing the way he has, too, in net, I mean, like, it's so hard to have a negative outlook about the future of this Preds team right now, where just as last year it was, oh, you're in the worst place in sports because you're not elite and you're not bad. So you got to blow it up. And without blowing it up, they've tweaked things and have made themselves better. I mean, this team, without a doubt, I don't think you can argue, is much better than last year.
Roman Josi, as a defenseman, has the sixth most points in the whole league.
He's going to break defensive scoring records.
Obviously, that leads all defensemen, but like, he's just behind McDavid, Dreisaitl, Gaudreau, Matthews, Huberdeau, and Kyle Connor. Like, those are the only guys who are ahead of him in total points. And he has a lot of ice time, but the points aren't cheap. They are not cheap points. They are not cheap points by any stretch of the imagination for Roman Josi, who had three straight three-point games last week, had a golden assist last night.
And only 2 points last night.
Yeah, I know.
Only.
What a down game for him. But talking about all the firepower they have, the most that the Preds have ever had, last night's power play goals speak to it. They scored three power play goals. The first one was 13 seconds into a power play. The second one was 39 seconds into a power play. The third one was 22 seconds into a power play. So that top unit, which is the top line, plus Granlund and Josi in the five-man power play unit, they scored three goals in a minute 14 off the opening face-off of power plays.
That's just imagine, like, take yourself back to 3 years ago when we were talking about this being the worst power play unit when everyone's yelling, shoot the puck, or like there's all this passing around the, you know, out around
everybody's
the perimeter,
standing
the blue
still.
Line. Everyone's standing still, and it's like the slow, methodical attack on the power play, almost inexcusable for a team that's playing with a man advantage to what you have right now. And the way this power play is played, with also, like, we've mentioned all these names, Mikael Granlund being on there has been fantastic. The way he's passed the puck this year has been able to facilitate is incredible. So imagine if he gets a little luckier around the net, you know? Like, he's creating shots for himself, too. It hasn't scored as many goals, but that's going to eventually change. That can't get, you know, lower. Imagine if you get him going anywhere like you have these guys in terms of scoring the puck, then, I mean, this team has what it takes to be able to make a little bit of a run. Here in a month and a half?
In the power play ozone cycle, we've seen so much east-west passing and movement, north-south passing and movement. It's not always going to be the same guy on the flank either. And John Hines has shouted that out a couple times. I mean, we had a goal in one of the home games last week where Roman Josi served it up from the flank on the right wall up to Ryan Johansson at the point for a one-timer goal.
Not how you'd
we
use
would
draw
not
it up.
Have seen that 2 years ago when everybody was in their assigned seat with their feet still, trying to just get something off. So it's been a big success story in a lot of ways for the Predators, but is it good enough to get them deep in the playoffs? Maybe. We'll see, but there's no reason not to go for it. So we'll take a break, come back with Jack Fraser. You know him on Twitter at JFreshHockey. He writes for EP Rinkside and some other analytical style NHL outlets. He has great player cards on Twitter, different attributes. Who's good at what is the layman's way to put it, and I like to say it that way. So we'll get Jack on, talk about the Preds, talk about their trade deadline acquisition of Jeremy Lauzon, and more. Max Herz and Elijah Campbell here on The 6 on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back to The 6 here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Max Herz and Elijah Campbell taking you up to Preds and Kings tonight. Puck drop will be at 9:30 here on 102.5 The Game with full pregame coverage starting at 8:30. Let's talk about the Preds with Jack Fraser of EP Ringside. You know him on Twitter as JFreshHockey. And pretty fitting as we bring Jack in that I think this is the first time we've ever had a guest on The 6 actually in Toronto. So, Jack, congrats on that. And thanks for joining us.
Thanks. I think this is the first time I've ever been led into by Lit. So it's the first time. Yeah.
We actually got to hear that song live at the Stadium Series, which was pretty cool. They were here.
So, I'm pretty jealous of that.
Yeah. Fun times at the outdoor game. And those of you who follow Jack on Twitter, JFreshHockey, see his great player cards and hockey analytics, who's good at what. Let's start, Jack, talking about the newest Predator, the only trade deadline pickup, at least on the NHL side for the Preds, left-handed defenseman Jeremy Lauzon, formerly of the Boston Bruins, most recently of the Seattle Kraken. Where do you think he fits in with this Preds group as a potential third-pair guy who can play both sides?
Yeah, third pair is probably where he's going to end up. He's played, I think, both the third and second pair in the past, certainly for Boston. You know, is he a guy that I necessarily would have targeted as somebody to spend a second-round pick on? Maybe not, but there is upside there. You know, he's relatively young. I think he's 24 or 25 years old. He's had good defensive results in the past. You know, he's played on two fairly structured defensive teams in Boston and in Seattle, and I think he's kept up well there. You know, the one thing that I think has been a real issue for him is penalties. He does tend to take quite a few penalties. I think he plays a kind of physical style of game that can occasionally translate to some discipline issues. But, you know, fundamentally speaking, I think you're getting a pretty, you know, I would say an almost garden variety kind of just solid defensive defenseman who, you know, plays a little bit aggressively and can maybe shut guys down off the rush.
Who were some of the defensemen that you expected to move that maybe didn't? And also guys that did move like Travis Dermott or even on the higher end side, Nick Leddy, who commanded a little bit more of a price tag that you thought the Predators maybe could have or should have been looking at?
Well, I think the number one guy who I really thought was going to be moved who wasn't was Calvin DeHaan, who plays for the Chicago Blackhawks, who is, I think, you know, fills a similar category in terms of he's definitely a defense-first guy. He's more of a veteran than Lauzon is, obviously, and he also probably would have required a bit of retention for most teams in the league. But I think he's just kind of, you know, he's a level up. I think he's a bona fide top four defenseman that I think a lot of playoff teams should have been interested in. But I think, you know, like you alluded to, you know, I think every team that had a slot to fill at the left defenseman spot in this top four pretty much did it. You know, you go down the list of Toronto and Boston and Nashville and St. Louis, and you're pretty much just listing teams that all paid a decent price to bring in a top four defenseman. So I can kind of see how in the musical chairs game, DeHaan got left behind, but he's definitely somebody that I would have looked at if I was looking to add some depth on D.
Talking with Jack Fraser of EP Ringside, and Jack, you're making me sound smart because Elijah and I were sitting right here 3 weeks ago, and I said Calvin DeHaan should be the Preds' number one target. So
can confirm.
Thank you for that. But looking at the Preds' D-core kind of bigger picture, obviously, especially on the left side, Josi's pair and Ekholm's pair command so many minutes. The Preds' third pair this season, when it's been the primary duo of Borowiecki and Benning, has been good. When it's been anybody else, it's been not so good. Has that hurt them as much as it seems like it may have when they've had to go deeper than that?
Yeah, which is why I think it made sense to fill things out. You know, I always liked the idea of them bringing in Benning and Borowiecki as that bottom pair, you know, when they did it. I guess probably back in 2020 it would have been. But, you know, when you, I think, commit to adding established NHL players on your bottom pair, you do leave yourself open to you know, having to bring up some call-ups or maybe some guys who, you know, in my world would be called sub-replacement players, but, mm-hmm. you know, otherwise would slot in as depth guys. And oftentimes when you end up doing that, you end up losing the minutes they play. So, you know, even if the price for LeVon was certainly high and higher than I think it's probably fair to say that I would have expected his market value to be, I can at least understand why they would have both decided to address that bottom pair as a priority and also to try to bring in somebody who's young enough that maybe they can be a sustainable solution.
Talking to Jack Fraser here at JFreshHockey on Twitter. Fantastic with hockey analytics and hockey analytics graphs, which I'm a fan of. I'm a fan of sports analytics graphs because, Jack, I am a simpleton. I need it put in front of me in simple terms in which I can visually look at and be amused. And you do a really good job of that. And I highly recommend anyone who wants to get into hockey analytics to follow your Twitter account. And one thing that I have a question about, too, is like here we talked about in the one of our first segments here on the show tonight. Roman Josi's value is pretty obvious, especially this year. 18 goals, 59 assists, 77 points. He's like top six in the league in points as a defenseman. But on the defensive side, where is his value analytically, or what do the numbers tell you about him on defensively when making the case for him to be the Norris Trophy winner, especially compared to Cale Makar? Because that's really the two in mind that I kind of see as the two best defensemen in the league right now.
Yeah, I'd say him and Makar, and I think Hedman has also made a good case for himself this season after, I think, a bit of an injured down year. And, I mean, you know, when you're talking about a down year for a guy who wins back-to-back cups, obviously you're not condemning him too hard.
Not a bad seat. You know, about four.
I would say that, you know, Josi and Makar, I think, are fairly similar defensively in that, you know, a lot of the time you talk about these guys who are elite defensive or offensive defensemen. You think in the past of Erik Karlsson and Brent Burns and Mike Green. You know, almost always you were giving something offensively, but you were taking something away defensively. I think with this maybe newer generation of talented offensive defensemen, I think they kind of, you know, they obviously the offense is the attraction, and they're not elite defensive players, but they are above water is how I would put it. So, you know, I don't think a lot of people would put either Cale Makar or Roman Josi on their list of the top defensive defensemen in the league, or even particularly high on that kind of list. But, you know, I'd say they're just solidly above average. They get the job done. And even if they're not, you know, guys that you would necessarily consider to be stay-at-home players, I think the things that they can do in transition and, you know, to keep possession alive in the offensive zone, it keeps the puck away from their net, which ultimately is, you know, that's a defensive play in and of itself. And there's plenty of players who play a transition game who are not good defensively. You know, I mean, you know, you mentioned Nick Leddy as somebody who changed hands. That's an example of a player who I think plays as a version of Roman Josi if Josi wasn't as talented in the offensive zone or was a lot worse in the defensive zone. But yeah, you know, both Makar, Josi, they're players who will wow you with their offensive talents, but they're not hurting you defensively either. And I think that that's what makes them especially interesting Norris candidates.
Talking Preds with Jack Fraser of EP Ringside here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Preds and Kings tonight at 9:30 out in L.A. Jack, about 2.5 weeks ago, the Preds made a move in their top six. Mikhail Granlund went down to the second-line center spot. Ryan Johansson came up to the top line to play with Matt Duchene and Philip Forsberg. Since then, the three far and away best offensive forwards on the Preds have played together, and it's been unbelievable. Both even strength and power play, all three of them have scored like crazy. What do you think about the Preds loading up, and is it a viable strategy to go deep in the playoffs that way?
Well, you know, I think when you have a team that isn't necessarily, you know, structured the way that a lot of them are in terms of their star players, you know, I think we can all agree that Philip Forsberg is obviously having a star turn this season. But other than that, you know, I think the Predators are generally a well-balanced offensive team. And that gives you a level of versatility where you can make those experiments. So, you know, considering the fact that they're not, you know, one of the higher tier contenders, you know, like they are really going to have to make kind of an impressive run to go deep in the playoffs this year. I think that you just have to roll with what works, and you have to try to gather as much momentum as you can, especially since they didn't make any additions to that forward group at the deadline, like I think some people thought they might. So, you know, honestly, with the way that these forwards, and a lot of them I think have surprised a lot of people this year, I think you really just have to keep rolling with whatever is working for you down the stretch, with the knowledge that the versatility of those pieces up front gives you the ability to shake things up if you need to.
Yeah, I agree with you on really all of that. I think they're in a good place with it right now. So we've talked enough about the skaters on this Preds team. Let's talk about UC Saros, who I know you love. What do the numbers say about why Saros has been so great this year, especially with a really heavy workload?
Yeah, I mean, he's just terrific. He has certainly had to do quite a bit. You know, I don't think anybody would deny that the Predators are not, you know, the staunch defensive squad that they were back in those 2016, 2017 days. They make him do a lot of work, and they have for the past couple of years. And, you know, it takes kind of a special class of goalie to be able to consistently provide strong results. You know, I think it's rarer than a lot of people really recognize. You know, goaltending is very reputation-driven, especially when you're talking about who elite guys are. And oftentimes you'll hear guys come up in those conversations who haven't put up strong results year after year. But Saros, for the past 2 years especially, and I think, you know, going back even further than that, he's been reliable in a way that not very many goalies are. You know, you're really talking about, you know, a very limited list of maybe five goalies in the league who you could reliably count on the way that you can with UC Saros. And I think he has made a very good case for himself to be, you know, if not top three for the Vezina, then certainly on a lot of ballots.
Another guy who is potentially up for an award, many folks around here hope, is Tanner Janot. I know you can't quantify physical play as much as you can some of his shooting numbers and things like that, but what do you think about the season Janot's had really fitting in with the change of identity on this team?
Yeah, you know, I think Janot has certainly done, I mean, he's obviously been very impressive and I think come out of nowhere for a lot of people. You know, there's some elements of his game that I think may prove to be somewhat unsustainable. You know, the shooting, for example, I think has driven quite a bit of his success. We'll see if he can keep the high percentage there. But, you know, something that you alluded to, you talked about the physicality numbers and, you know, obviously, you know, things like hits and stuff, those can be kind of sketchy stats,
yeah,
especially the way that they're recorded. But one thing that does strike me quite a bit about Janot looking over his numbers, there's a hockey analyst named Corey Schneider who does manual stat tracking where he'll watch, you know, hundreds of games in a season and track everything that happens and who all the players were and everything. And it gives us, you know, stats that are akin to what, you know, the teams themselves are working with, mm-hmm, just really detailed data. And if you look at Tanner Janot's forechecking numbers, you know, there's two kind of main stats that he tracks, like on the forechecking. It's pucks recovered in the offensive zone off of dump-ins, and it's, you know, pressures, you know, which is where an opposing defenseman is trying to break out the puck and a forward puts pressure on that defenseman. And, you know, I'm looking at Janot's numbers. You know, he's in the 95th percentile in terms of recovering pucks in the offensive zone and the 97th percentile in terms of putting pressure on opposing defensemen.
Wow.
You know, those are obviously, you know, elite numbers in that area, and I would be very encouraged about that. And oftentimes the players who do rank super, super well in terms of their ability to forecheck and then just put constant pressure on defensemen on the other team, you know, they tend to end up having very good defensive numbers as well. So, you know, the offense might be very impressive for a lot of people this year, but if he can kind of develop into a very strong forechecking kind of two-way type winger, then I think that would be really encouraging for the Predators.
Jack Fraser is our guest from EP Ringside at JFresh Hockey. And Jack, last hockey question for you, then we got a fun one. But the Predators will go far in the playoffs because blank, based on what you have, and the Predators could flame out based on blank.
Well, I would say that Saros would be the answer to the first one. You know, having a goalie of his talent always gives you a chance. We've seen that time and time again. You know, I mean, the past 2 years especially, I think we've seen some Cinderella runs to the cup that in large part were powered by elite goaltending. And like I said, you know, Saros is one of the top five goalies in the NHL. In terms of why they wouldn't go far, I think they'd probably be a lot of the same reasons that a lot of people were skeptical about the team to begin with, which is the forward group falling down to earth. You know, Philip Forsberg, you know, he had an incredible night last night. He's had an incredible season. He's also shooting 22.7% which is, you know, if he could keep shooting like that for a long time, we'd be talking about him as, you know, the greatest scorer in NHL history. You know, he's going to fall down to earth a little bit. And, you know, if that snake bitten streak does come during the playoffs, then I think, you know, the bottom could fall out of the Predators' offense just a little bit. You know, if we see some of their offensive players like Granlund or Johansson or Duchesne maybe start to fall back a little bit to how they looked last year, that could obviously be a concern. So, you know, that would be the biggest issue. And, I mean, also, there are some really good teams in the NHL this year, you know, and they got better at the trade deadline. So, you know, you could make a very long list of teams that have a good chance of winning the Stanley Cup, but there's only one cup rewarded at the end of the year. So it's going to be real tough for any team that's not in that top category to really make a deep run.
All right, Jack, lastly, and the most important question here. On your Twitter account, the profile picture, we have a guess that it's Patrick Laine, but we're not 100% sure. It's like 80% Laine, 20% Drill.
So, yeah. So, it is Patrick Laine.
Okay, knew it.
He took a picture, he didn't take a picture. Somebody took a picture of him walking to a game looking like Jack Nicholson. And I think somebody pointed out to me that it reminded them of the popular Twitter user Drill.
Yes.
So I applied some filters onto it to make it look like it. And then I think my plan was to go with it temporarily and then switch it back to my old one. But I actually lost my old one. So until I can track it down again, I'm stuck with Patrick Laine Drill.
It's hockey Drill. That's amazing.
I'm so glad you were right, Elijah. Okay. I'm glad we came out with that because we were 100% right. Jack Fraser is on Twitter at JFreshHockey. He does great job with player cards, analytics, numbers for EP Ringside. And Jack, tell everybody how they can help you out too with your Substack and other ways they can get more of your advanced stuff.
I will. But first, I will mention, you know, for people who don't have spend nearly as much time on Twitter as I do, when you have enough followers, you start to get like a lot of spam. Like you get a lot of bot accounts trying to DM you and get your information. And a lot of the time they will be pretending to be attractive women and they will say, "Hey, handsome, I saw your profile picture and you were so attractive." And of course, it's Patrick Laine wearing sunglasses. So that always makes me laugh.
That's a good bot filter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can catch my work at EP Ringside. I just wrote a big article breaking down, you know, grading every team's performance at the deadline. And, you know, I do a lot of player breakdowns and things like that. You can follow me on Twitter at JFreshHockey. On top of posting hockey stats, visualizations, I also every day will post a little two-minute highlight film of, you know, whoever the top performer that previous night was. So, for example, I posted a little compilation of Philip Forsberg's plays from last night when he scored 5 points. If you like the stats visualizations that I alluded to or that you've seen me post on Twitter, if you would please consider subscribing to my Patreon. For $5 a month, you can access absolutely everything.
That's great. Jack Fraser at JFreshHockey. Thanks so much for joining us, Jack.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
We'll take a break, come back, talk some more Preds before the game tonight against the Kings. You're listening to The Six here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back to The Six here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Max Herz with Elijah Campbell here. Great job talking Preds. Fun segment with Jack Fraser. At JFreshHockey on Twitter is where you can find him. And he lives in Toronto, and he does not discriminate about what teams he does breakdowns of, player cards for. He is on it for every team every week. And like you heard, his player of the night league-wide last night was Philip Forsberg. And for very good reason, as he had 2 goals, 3 assists, points on the Preds' final 5 of their 6 goals, and he became the leading single-season goal scorer in Preds history with 35. After he became the leading all-time regular season goal scorer in Preds history with 212, now 214, he broke the record on Saturday night, and I don't think he's going to stop.
Nope. I mean, it certainly doesn't seem like it, too. And the funny thing about Forsberg scoring these, and even the Duchesne goal, because Duchesne's on a tear right now, too. Watching those guys, like every goal that you see, it's like you're always finding yourself wanting to rewind it and watch it again. I think I watched the Matt Duchesne goal where it goes between his legs. That was number 2 play.
And Forsberg just did that last week, too.
Yeah, exactly. Like these guys do this all the time. Like there is a highlight mania that goes along with like the entertainment value that goes along with the actual production that's on the ice right now. Like, the combination of those two is what you want in pro sports. You know, like, there's teams that are fun to watch that aren't that good, or teams that are really, really good, but might not be as aesthetically pleasing. And here in town, in the NHL, you have probably one of the best combinations of those two right now. It's awesome. Last night was so much fun.
Yeah.
You don't get a lot of those in a regular season hockey on a nightly basis. This team can do that.
Yeah. A lot of high-scoring games in the league this year, and the Preds have certainly played in some fun ones. And it was the Preds' debut for their only NHL-level trade deadline acquisition. They made some kind of minor league-level trades as well yesterday to fill some organizational needs, help another team with an organizational need in the Kings, trading Frederick Allard from the Admirals over to there. But their only NHL trade was getting Jeremy Lauzon, left-handed shooting defenseman, was on the Bruins for his first three NHL seasons, expansion draft to the Kraken, and after 53 games with the Kraken this season, traded to Nashville for a second-round pick this year. He's 24 years old. He's from Val d'Or, Quebec. Played for the Rouen Huskies in the Q. And he's a solid defenseman. And he's someone who David Poile has said now a couple of times, including on 102.5 The Game earlier today, they've had their eyes on. They've had their eyes on this player, and as they've watched him, they've noted that he is getting better. And I think that's big, because this is not a rental. He's a restricted free agent, so what that means basically is if the Predators want to keep him this offseason, they can, and it sounds like they will.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too, is like you don't want to give up, especially like second-rounders, for rentals, right? Like,
yeah.
They've already been in the stream. They've been snake-bitten by some of these kind of moves, too, like the Ryan Hartman thing. You have a first for – he wasn't necessarily a rental, but you end up trading him, so like it basically was a rental, but also – maybe not getting in return what you wanted. But the defensive depth is what this team really needed. And moving forward, too, because you don't know exactly what you have in a lot of your minor league prospects on the defensive side, too. What is Jeremy Davies? You know, what is a lot of those guys that down there? I think this at least gives you more of a picture of what you're going to have moving forward when it comes to your bottom defensive pairs. And so not only is it going to help this year, it also helps add a little bit of stability moving forward without it being pricey, so to speak. I know we mentioned a couple weeks ago when we were talking about trade deadline options like Calvin DeHaan or Nick Leddy. Those would have been more expensive options too. It would have been harder to work some things around. This one, I think, is a nice fair presentation of it not being as much, with also giving you a sense of what you know at the end of your defensive pairing and rotation.
Well, what the Preds did Saturday night against the Maple Leafs basically showed that they were going to do something on D. I would have liked them to get two, but what they did in that game, Mark Borowiecki and Matt Benning were both out. So two absences on the bottom pair. They had been playing their seventh and eighth organizational defenseman and Ben Harper on the left side, who's been with the big club all year, and Phil Myers on the right side, who's been up and down throughout the season. Part of the return for Ryan Ellis, what the real gain in that trade was a salary dump.
Was not having to pay.
But
yeah,
Myers was someone who they wanted in the NHL some this year, but maybe not in a full role. What they did on Saturday, instead of playing defensemen 7 and 8 who were healthy and available and had played all week, they waived one of them. They had to. They waived Phil Myers. They healthy scratched Ben Harper, and they called up defensemen 9 and 10, which was Jeremy Davies on the left, playing in his second NHL game this season, and then Matt Tennyson on the right, who has been in the lineup since then, will play in his seventh NHL game of the year tonight. When you're going to your ninth and your tenth, maybe it was a little bit of an audition for those guys, but it says more about 7 and 8.
Yeah,
and that's where they
and
needed the help.
All.
They that's
trust
where they
those
needed
guys
the help.
At all. And you could tell, too. Like, especially, like, Ben Harper, man, he's had a rough season. There's been a lot of games where you can see where some of those struggles, turning the puck over, some of those decisions have – cost him some goals. You can just tell they don't trust him
a
ton.
And Jeremy Lauzon played 18 minutes and 12 seconds on 25 shifts last night. He played on the second pair because Mattias Ekholm was sick and not playing in the game, but that's a lot of ice time. He killed penalties. He played well. And in an interview that you will hear in full on Preds pregame tonight, I think Ryan Johansson summed up pretty well what Jeremy Lauzon brought in his Preds debut.
You know, you'd love to see a new guy make an impact right away, and I was back checking in our first shift together, and boom, he made a huge hit there at center ice, and I thought it was Borrow. I was like, oh, that's not Borrow, and I'm like, oh, that's the new guy.
That's the new kid.
Ryan Johansson, ladies and gentlemen. That's the new guy. So we'll see Jeremy Lauzon in his second Preds game tonight. Sounds like David Riddick will be in goal. We don't know that for sure. No surprise after UC Saros played last night. But Riddick got in there for 42 seconds because of an equipment malfunction.
42-second shutout. So he did not give up a goal.
Preds and Kings tonight at 9:30. You can hear it on 102.5 The Game. Watch it on ESPN+. He's Elijah Campbell. For our producer, Jared Cassidy, I'm Max Herz. That's it for the 6 tonight. We'll talk to you at 8:30 for Preds pregame.